with Rolled Burbank Funk. Sky Zoo in the Hypnotic Brass Ensemble with Bed-Stuy Is Burning. Soul from the O, new music from Queens and Pharaohs. We heard When We Meet Again. Butcher Brown with I Never Knew. And Be Kool-Aid and Friends with Can't Go Back, starting us off. My name is Milo Grant. This is WRUV FM Burlington. We're 90.1 on your dial, and you can stream us at WRUV.org. We thank you so much for listening, leaving you with some beats from DJ Luck, MC Neat, Classic UK Garage.
We done falsifying. A DJ Luck jump it with the rhythm and a rhyme. The DJ Luck jump it with the bad bass line. Bad bass line. Bad bass line. Bad bass. Bad bass. Bad bass line. Holla with the rinsing sound, holla with the rinsing sound, holla with the rinsing sound, holla with the mixing sound, holla with the rinsing 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 sound, holla with the mixing sound, holla with the rinsing sound, holla with the mixing sound.
Tana ning 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 t
lock, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, can me get you denied. With a little bit of luck, we can make it you denied. With a little bit of luck, we can make it you denied. With a little bit of luck, we can make it you denied. With a little bit of luck, we can make it you denied. With a little bit of luck, we can make it you denied. With a little bit of luck,
according to Ron Okua from USDA.gov, 99.9% of humans carry them. We're talking about face mites, such as Demodex folliculorum. Get ready to turn up this radio station, because when you fall asleep, they like to come out and have little parties. Even on a larger scale, you are not alone. This world's population density is on average 59.74 people per square kilometer, according to macrotrends.net. And specifically within the US, our density is 96 people per square mile, according to the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs. While we're at it, on a much, much larger scale, the probability that there exists other planets in our universe that harbor intelligent life as we know it is found by the Drake Equation, which, referencing this with NASA's website, they estimate the probability that we are alone is 1 in 10 billion trillion. This interesting message brought to you by your personal wall inhabitant DJs here at WRUV-FM Burlington. We'll be right back.
Are you listening to WRUV FM Burlington? This is James, and you're listening to the show Radio Lyceum. So the theme of the show this semester is about sociology, social capital. Philosophy's mixed in a little bit, and how to self-help. Group help? It's not really, I'm not trying to promote self-help, I'm trying to promote, go out and help everyone else around you. So, we're going to be starting out with philosophy this week. I promise you guys I'm going to do a little bit of philosophy. We're going to do a little bit of Ludwig Wittgenstein in under 30 minutes. Exciting. And kind of tie it in with sociology. So, we'll start out with that. And that's from Sergiu. He has... Michael Sergiu, who has a bunch of philosophy lectures online. We're going to be splitting them up and talking about it a little bit. And then we'll be talking about how to socialize. How to be good at small talk. It's not really small talk, but how to talk to people. I figured, hey, we're talking about how to interact with people. We should have a little bit of a guide to be how to talk to strangers or non-strangers or whatever. And some stuff from John Cacioppo, talking about the lethality of loneliness. And everyone's excited to have a little bit of 17-minute rant talking about history and how you can go out and talk to your neighbors and make some change. So... without further ado, let's fade out this track in the background. In case you want to know, this is Kraftwerk. And this is the Deranged Zero Gravity remix of that track. Number here is 656-439-4399. You can also instant message me through WRUV.org. We have a little chat thing on there. I also have an email for the show, radiolyceum@protonmail.com. So you can email me if you want to. I know I was supposed to get to Henry David Thoreau, I promised you at some point, but I keep on getting stuff mixed in. I'm like, yeah, I'll play it next week. So, next week maybe.
In the Tractatus, Wittgenstein had an idea, or made essentially the argument, or had the basic conception, that language was a picture of the world, and that each individual atomic proposition told us something about the world, or it told us about some logical fact. So there were two kinds of meaningful propositions in the Tractatus, and only two. There were deductive facts, and there were inductive facts. Deductive facts are either true or false, and he worked out the implications of that. It turns out that all true deductive statements, all analytic facts, are in fact tautologies. In other words, they only tell you that X is X. Now, it may be a very abstract set of equations on both sides, but really what it all reduces to is everything is itself. Every mathematical equation says that this is this, and nothing more. It tells us nothing about the world, it just tells us about the logical entailments in our definitions. Very clean, very precise. He has a razor blade of a mind, and he cuts right through all the nonsense, all the complexities, to get to one basic core. In the Tractatus, he also says that another kind of proposition expresses the contingent states of affairs in the world. The chair is there, the audience is here, I'm walking up and down. All these propositions tell us individual facts about the world, and these are not tautologies, these are not contradictions. They are simple contingencies, and the way you find out about them is by looking at the world. Elegant, simple, lovely. Perhaps a little too simple, perhaps an oversimplification. In his later work, when he gets to the investigations, Wittgenstein has decided that instead of language being a picture, he wants to treat language as a game. as a set of social practices which overlap and which don't have one universal skeleton key which allows us to open all linguistic doors. Instead, there are a plurality of overlapping games which have a certain degree of consistency within them, but there's no one unifying characteristic that covers all possible linguistic expressions. Now let's think about the idea of language games. Wittgenstein says that there are different kinds of games that we play, and that language can be subsumed under that idea, and that not all these games are perfectly identical, and that there's a certain degree of ambiguity that attaches to some games rather than others. And in fact, the plurality and diversity of languages of language makes it resist any attempt to find a universal kind of algorithm which allows you to get through all of it. Remarkable change of intellectual orientation comes here. Now, the question is, if we're to take this idea of language games seriously, we have to figure out what we would mean by a language game, how these games will work, and what it is that's different in this second conception, this conception of the language game, that makes it different from the conception that he had earlier. Two of Wittgenstein's favorite questions come into play here. One of his favorite questions is, how is a word learned? That is to say, if you want to define, if you want to know about the meaning of a word, X, then ask yourself, how do you find out about X? How would you teach X to a six-year-old? Because as a matter of practical, empirical fact, all the six-year-olds, all the children in our culture are going to have to be taught the words of English, and they get taught them one by one. Ask yourself how you would teach a word. That will tell you a great deal about what the word means and what the word signifies. In addition to that, he wants to know a second question that Wittgenstein is particularly interested in is, how is a word used? One of the slogans that was derived from this a little later in Wittgenstein's development was, don't ask for the meaning, ask for the use. If you want to know what X means, ask yourself what people do with it. Go look at people using the word X and find out what it's good for. And when you know how they use it, well, then you know what it means. This change from the logical necessity of language to its practical contingency is a fascinating turnabout.
So that's Michael Sergiu. He has a lot of lectures online talking about philosophy in general. But I want to talk about that little clip. In general, this kind of, when I was young, I always thought like maybe the limitations of our understanding in some science is limited by the language you use. Because there's some concept so outside the bounds of how we perceive the world. How could we ever hope to understand it? So he's talking about how language is constructed through its use. By examples, like defining life. What is alive and what not? Is it a chemical reaction? Is a chemical reaction life? It's like when you get towards the boundary, it gets harder and harder to at the fuzzier edges to kind of nail it down on what is the boundary between it. So if you want to know the meaning of a word, you need to know how it's used. I think that's kind of the gist of not the Tractatus, but his second, the Investigations, his second work, which is basically dismantling his fourth work. But Sergiu, much better explaining it than me. You could also tie this to Aristotle's idea of telos, or purpose. It's an idea that I use immensely all the time to help boil down ideas, how I approach most problems at all. Most people kind of get stuck up on trying to solve a problem by looking at too many variables. I'm like, okay, what is the purpose of what you're trying to do here? And it's a really effective way to kind of boil down a lot of discussions. And we often get sunk into the language games of the things we're trying to do or boil down and what its purpose and how can we achieve its purpose. I think it's a good way to. So that kind of ties in with what he's saying. So let's get into part two. He talks a little bit more about Liechtenstein. Very, very fascinating. So let's get into it. Number here is 656-4399. You can IM me through WRUE.org.
Now, let's think about the word game. I assume all of us have a sufficient command of English to roughly know what a game is. And the problem is, one of definition. How will we define game? Let's think about our six-year-old. Let's call him Johnny. And let's say we want to teach a game to Johnny. Now, by six, most children actually know what a game is already. And the question is this. How did we teach Johnny the term game? And how do we know when Johnny understands the word game? And
so for Wittgenstein,
what does it mean for us to define the word game? Well, we'd have to drop back a little bit and see what Wittgenstein is fighting against in the Western philosophical tradition. In other words, what's the definition of definition in the Western philosophical tradition? A kind of meta question, kind of bootstraps us up into a new level. And the best example, the best contrast you can find is in the works of Plato. Socrates is constantly asking people, what is justice? What is goodness? What is virtue? What is beauty? And what he's asking for is a definition, because in each of the Socratic dialogues, there's an attempt to define some important abstract concept. And in fact, in the process of defining it, Socrates has very clear criteria for what counts as a definition. Those of you who are familiar with the Republic know that Socrates wants to define justice. Those of you who are familiar with the Phaedrus know that Socrates wants to define love. Those of you who are familiar with the Meno know that Socrates wants to define virtue. When Socrates in the Meno asks Meno, what is virtue? Meno gives him a bunch of examples. There's the virtue of generals, the virtue of soldiers, the virtue of men, the virtue of women. And Socrates says, no, stop, stop. I don't want examples of virtue. I want to know what virtue itself is. I want to know some quality that every virtue has and only virtue has. In other words, Socrates demands that virtue be defined in the way that we define odd numbers or triangles. He wants the canons for definition to be strictly mathematical. It goes back to the fact that the Greeks were primarily concerned with mathematical epistemological questions, or at least Plato was. And Socrates wins many arguments by showing that nobody understands what virtue or justice or beauty is, because no one can tell him what the form of it is. No one can tell him what every instantiation of beauty has and only instantiations of beauty has. No one can tell him what every example of virtue has and only examples of virtue have. It's not an accident that Socrates, whenever he gives an example of what he wants a definition to be, always chooses some mathematical entity. Mathematical things lend themselves to that kind of definition. The difficulty that Wittgenstein has stumbled on, and it's a fascinating problem, is that many things are not and cannot be defined that way. In other words, he thinks Socrates is unintentionally playing intellectual sleight of hand by demanding of people something that couldn't possibly be there. And then it turns out that when the people try and give him what he wants, they end up looking stupid because they're on an expedition to do the impossible. A remarkable insight. Wittgenstein offers us a new idea. Let's go back to Johnny and the game. Johnny understands the game. And what's remarkable is that none of us sat down and said, Johnny, every game has the following quality, and only games have the following qualities. Johnny, this is the form of the game. As a matter of fact, if called upon to tell someone what the form of the game is, in other words, if called upon to say some quality that every game has and only games have, I think you'd run into all kinds of problems. Ask yourself what the Olympics have in common with tic-tac-toe. Ask yourself what poker has in common with chess. Ask yourself what tag has in common with peekaboo. Ask yourself if any of these things have one universal characteristic that allows us to say that all these things are games. If they don't have one universal characteristic, how is it that we can use the word in a sensible way? What does it mean to describe all these things as games? Wittgenstein has opened up a can of skeptical worms here, and he's going to close it, too. Quite remarkable. Let's go back to Johnny and our game. We teach Johnny peekaboo. We teach Johnny maybe a card game. We teach Johnny